Welcome, investors, to the Absolute Return Podcast, your source for stock market analysis, global macro musings, and hedge fund investment strategies. Your hosts, Julian Klimochko and Michael Kesslering, aim to bring you the knowledge and analysis you need to become a more intelligent and wealthier investor. This episode is brought to you by Accelerate Financial Technologies. Accelerate, because performance matters. Find out more at accelerateshares.com.
Welcome, podcast listeners, to episode 75 of the Absolute Return Podcast. I'm Julian Klimochko.
And I'm Mike Kessler.
Lovely July 3rd, 2020 today. Sun is shining. Happy Independence Day to all our American listeners and for our Canadian listeners. Canada Day this week as well. So fairly slow market action. Many market participants on holidays. Certainly a lot of people taking a long weekend this weekend, so it should be a good one. Nonetheless, there were some notable events that we wanted to analyze and discuss today. Some action in the SPAC sector. Special purpose acquisition company Landcadia Holdings announced a merger with Golden Nugget Online Gaming. What does the market think? That's right, this could be the next DraftKings. Super, super hot stock. Lululemon to acquire at-home fitness startup Mirror for $500 million. Why are they buying it? Is this just a continuation of that work from home, be at home trend that we've seen powering Peloton and others like it? Lastly, we're going to talk about hedge fund manager John Paulson, who implemented the, quote, greatest trade ever. He retired. What are his plans now and why is he returning capital to investors? But first, wanted to chat about this SPAC deal. Blank check company Landcadia Holdings 2. It's actually run by gaming magnate Tilman Fertitta. Also, Jefferies, the investment bank, is involved. They struck a deal to combine with Golden Nugget Online Gaming for $745 million, a bit of a related party transaction because Tilman Fertitta's company also owns Golden Nugget Online Gaming. But it's a successful private company at this point, Golden Nugget. It's profitable. It's a leader in New Jersey's burgeoning online gambling market. It accounts for roughly 34% of New Jersey's $86 million gross gaming revenue in May. So they are a leader in the online gaming space. And this is really just a sector that can have explosive growth going into the future. They're predicting that it could be a $20 billion market opportunity. And right now, in terms of Golden Nugget's estimated 2020 results, they're calling for $95 million in revenue, $24 million in adjusted EBITDA. So that's a proxy for cash flow. So a lot of growth runway is what management is seeing. And this company is growing like a weed. 3-year revenue compound annual growth rate of nearly 50%, 50%. And especially during the pandemic, it's been growing like crazy. Between January and April this year, revenue up 55%. So certainly management is thinking this is a tremendous growth opportunity in a market where there's not a lot of growth and market participants are really paying up for those growth opportunities and what we like to call story stocks. If you have a good story, a good pitch, especially in the pandemic coronavirus era, you have so-called work-from-home stocks, those stocks and those companies that benefit from people being stuck at home, such as Peloton on the exercise at-home fitness trend, or Zoom video, Zoom communications that capitalizes on work-from-home. Certainly, Golden Nugget Online Gaming is a continuation of that trend, of which the market has really, really been rewarding lately. I wanted to compare this to another company, DraftKings, because Golden Nugget will be only the second publicly traded online gambling company next to DraftKings. And if you look at DraftKings, man, has that been a stock market winner? Their share price has gone bonkers. They actually went public through a SPAC as well earlier this year, and the stock's up 209% year to date. And if we look at the valuation metrics on these companies, just on a per revenue basis, because DraftKings at this point is unprofitable, so the market's assigning roughly 15 times revenue multiple to DraftKings. And when it first went public through the SPAC, it was valued at 5 times. So pretty similar initial revenue valuation multiple. But since then, the stock's gone from 10 to 30, north of 30 bucks on the DraftKings side. As for now, the market certainly likes this Golden Nugget Online Gaming deal with Landcadia stock up about 50% on the news to kind of in the $15 range. The deal has not closed yet. It was just announced that they did sign a purchase agreement, which differs from a number of SPAC deals that we've seen announced over the past month. Some of them just signed letter of intents, which are non-binding. This one is a binding deal. It is a purchase agreement. So it does provide more certainty in closing, which is expected in the third quarter. And once it does go public, it'll be trading under the symbol GNOG, GNOG. A bit of disclosure. So we are long the SPAC Landcadia units, shares, and warrants, which we always buy these things pre-deal. We never go and we're trying to harvest that upside optionality, which, I mean, they certainly saw in this one. It does lend credence to our thesis of getting involved in SPACs pre-deal for that arbitrage, preferably get into the SPACs at a discount so you're guaranteed that baseline return. And on a stock like Landcadia, it just goes to show you there is explosive upside if they do announce a deal that the market deems attractive. And if you look over the past month, retail speculators specifically have been getting really, really hot on these deals. And so that's another important dynamic to take into account, is there's a bit of a shareholder base turnover that is powering SPAC share price returns. If you look at SPAC IPO, the guys subscribing to the IPO at $10 a share, these are largely hedge funds, and they hold it, doesn't really do a lot pre-deal. It slowly ticks up as the treasury, the cash accrues interest and the NAV increases. However, once a deal is announced, if it's a hot deal, if you know speculators can kind of get involved and they like the story, if they can really sell the story, then there's this turnover where it starts to get bid up by retail speculators, retail traders, guys in Reddit forums, Robinhood traders, etc. There's this turnover as hedge funds exit. They earn that profit that they're looking for, that upside optionality, and then it gets owned by these more retail investors that power the stock higher, as we've seen on DraftKings, as we saw on Nikola and other super, super successful stocks year to date. And they all have the same story. High growth opportunity, not profitable yet, very early stage, and you're seeing nothing different here. And so it really has the right formula to be a stock market winner, as we've seen many of these precedent deals do. So that's something to keep in mind, this shareholder-based turnover, which we're now starting to get through. The stock's up about 50%, so hedge funds are selling, more and more retail investors are buying. And then ironically, after the deal completes and switch this ticker to GNOG, it's now an independent company. Then the ETFs come in. There's that BETZ, B-E-T-Z ETF, which I'm sure will be a major buyer off of the retail speculators. So it's kind of what I call a circle of life with a SPAC stock, where it goes from hedge funds, stock goes up to retail speculators, and then they make money selling to the ETF. So it's a really interesting dynamic there, a circle of life of SPACs and how it can be kind of the formula to profitably trade these things. A great case study with the SPAC Landcadia Holdings and this Golden Nugget online gaming deal. So I like it. I think it's a pretty cool deal. What are your thoughts on this one, Mike?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. You bring up the shareholder base turnover, is you look at right now, I believe it was two or three days ago, I was seeing on the Robin track that the amount of users, Robinhood users, were around 16,000 users were holding it in their accounts.
Landcadia. And now that, LCA.
Yes. Yep. Yes, LCA. And by today, you're seeing that, well, as of yesterday, I guess, since US markets are closed, you're seeing 20,000 users holding it. So there's been a lot of day over day growth as retail digests this deal. And that's what's interesting, is you look at DraftKings, you look at some of the other story stocks on Robinhood, is that they have these jumps and they'll go, you know, jumping from 5,000 share users to 20,000 can take a couple of days. And then all of a sudden you go from 20,000 to 60,000 and 100,000 over the next coming weeks as well, which is very interesting. Now that can cut both ways with story stocks that, you know, investors just get bored of the story or they tire from it. But this seems to be one of the trends and stories that is fairly, retail does have a lot of appetite for it. It's not just retail. Investors in general are looking for ways to play online gambling. And that's where I did want to just differentiate a little bit with DraftKings is that their focus, so Golden Nugget Online, their focus is casino gambling. So table games and online slot, things of that nature. Whereas DraftKings is a pure play focus on sports betting, both of which have a lot of tailwinds in terms of being brought online in the U.S. Now, in the U.S. right now, for sports gambling, there is, I believe it's 11 or 12 states where it has been legalized. Whereas you look at the overall table games, just irregular casino gambling, where there's, I believe, only three states that do offer this, that it is legal in, mm-hmm. where there's a couple more that should be coming. I believe it's four more states have the potential for being added to that list.
Right, but the long-term opportunity will be the entire country is kind of the investment thesis.
Yeah, exactly. And so when you're looking, it is just in a bit more of its infancy than sports betting. But part of that is a good thing as well, as you had mentioned during the pandemic, there's no sports. So anybody investing in DraftKings is really just making a bet on the world moving back to a pre-COVID the climate where you know, you do have actual, like, a lot of sports going on. And as well as DraftKings, their focus was a lot of fantasy football, especially in fantasy sports, which was another tailwind to take advantage of in the U.S. But with Golden Nugget, they're also expanding. They've already kind of announced that they are expanding into Pennsylvania. And so they'd started just in New Jersey. They're expanding into Pennsylvania and Michigan, which are high-value states, targeting 2021. And that's pending regulatory approval. So once they get it's legal in those states, they will be moving into those. As you had mentioned, they're just growing their revenue at a very high clip. They are showing positive adjusted EBITDA. So they are working towards becoming truly cash positive, which is a positive for them moving forward. And really just lends a lot of credence to the thought that Tillman Fertitta, that this was all along kind of a strategy to take this area of the business public, as there's a couple other options that you could take doing an IPO, a traditional IPO, where you go on a roadshow and you market it to all these institutions, and that's likely a 6-month process. You could also look at a direct listing, where, you know, it may be in a similar time frame. Whereas through a SPAC, it's really a 3-month time frame, mm-hmm. is what he's looking at for this. So it's a lot quicker way to go public, and depending on how you view it, in terms of cash costs, it definitely is cheaper. But you are giving up some of the pro forma entity to the SPAC shareholders, so you are paying for that a bit. But this will certainly be one that will be interesting to watch. As of right now, as well, as long as the stock or the SPAC trades through its NAV value, well, then there really is unlikely to be shareholders redeeming. So whatever is in Lancadia for cash is highly likely to remain with the company and allow the company to use that to pay down some debt.
Right, exactly. Because no one's going to redeem their shares for net asset value of $10 and change when the stock's at $15. One thing I wanted to touch on, continue the discussion on shareholder turnover. So LCA Lancadia has roughly 31.6 million shares outstanding. And already this week, the deal got announced and over 50 million shares and units have traded. So perhaps a large portion of that shareholder turnover has already occurred. So that's something to keep in mind, because if you have a so-called overhang on a stock on a large exiting shareholder, that can always hold it back. And once you get through that overhang, can sometimes experience pretty explosive gains. So it's obviously one that we're interested in due to the fact that we are long units, shares, and warrants of this one, and we think it's a cool deal, so we'll continue to monitor it. And as we indicated, market likes it already. Stock up nearly 50%, and it's expected to close this quarter. So GNOG, you'll see public perhaps by September. Another really interesting deal announced in the market this week. Perhaps another way to capitalize on the popularity of, you know, being at home during the pandemic. You look at the popularity of Peloton, in-home fitness. It's this new trend that's absolutely been accelerated due to COVID-19, this whole stay-at-home dynamic. What happened here, athleisure retailer Lululemon announced their first acquisition ever with a $500 million deal for in-home fitness startup Mirror. Now, Mirror is really interesting. So you basically put this device on your wall. It's basically a mirror, but far, far more expensive, about $1,500 up front, plus a $40 per month subscription fee. So that offers live classes through that so-called mirror, in addition to on-demand workouts, personal training, and things like that. So basically anything you can get at a gym, you can now do at home. Some background on the company: 3 years old, it had raised roughly $72 million from venture capitalists and other investors, and now it's worth $500 million. So certainly a big win for investors on this one. Big win for Lululemon shareholders as well. The market liked it. Their shares rallying 4% on the news. Interesting factoid is that Lululemon actually invested in Mirror $1 million into the round they did in 2019. So they were familiar with the company. It shouldn't come as a huge surprise, but I always thought Mirror was, you know, pretty potential fad and, you know, really odd. But what are your thoughts on it? I know we had some colorful comments when we first heard of it.
Yeah. I mean, when we had I'd been served an ad for Mirror. This would have been at some point in 2019, I think maybe perhaps even around this time in 2019. And it is no doubt, and it was really around the time of the Peloton IPO. And for, you know, us as Accelerate, as a firm, looking into new issues and things of that nature. And then as well doing some background reading for our podcast, as we did discuss Peloton, I was served an ad for Mirror. And I remember looking at it and I clicked into it, and they had, you know, very good marketing and whatnot, but I genuinely thought that it was a
Saturday Night Live commercial.
Yeah, that it was like a parody of Peloton and kind of like the ridiculousness. As around that time, there was a lot of Peloton parodies where they would make fun of some of their marketing, which I would argue also that is their marketing being quite successful because people were talking about it. But I truly did think it was a parody because I was like, what? Like, it's just a mirror. That obviously it's expensive. There's a lot of technology in there, but the whole concept of it just didn't really make sense to me. And when you do mention, you know, you are looking at similar costs to a Peloton in terms of the all-in cost, where the mirror itself being $1,500 and then $40 a month for your subscription. I just thought, you know, the value add with Peloton to me made a bit more sense. Not that I was, you know, I wasn't jumping out to buy a Peloton. But as well, when I pair to the two companies, because I think they are quite comparable, especially with how users have reacted during COVID, is you've seen the app downloads for Mirror as well as Peloton just go haywire, going basically up over 100% month over month, especially during the lockdown. But looking at them and comparing them, I just saw everything that I would read about Peloton talked about their rabid user base and how they did have a core group of users that were very hooked on the product, that were very vocal about that as well. And they had quite a community built up online of this user base, where I'm not really seeing the same thing for Mirror. Now, Mirror does have a number of celebrity endorsers, I believe Reese Witherspoon being one, a few others, but I'm not seeing the kind of grassroots level of engagement as you did with Peloton. And as well, like looking at the deal right now, admittedly, we aren't able to go as in depth as Peloton because Peloton went public. They had their S-1 that they had to provide a certain amount of disclosure, whereas Mirror right now, they are not very forthcoming with subscriber numbers and things of that nature. As I the main quote I've seen for subscriber numbers is in the tens of thousands. So really not giving a lot of detail. They expect $100 million in revenue this year and expect to break even in 2021. So who knows with that? But I did find it was an interesting deal. I'm not going to be jumping out to purchase one. And yeah, I don't think the value prop to customers, given the price point, the high fixed cost upfront, as well as the, you know, you're still paying $40 a month instead of a gym subscription, theoretically. I don't think that that pays off for investors or for consumers in this situation, but to each their own.
Dumb question for you, Mike. Isn't Mirror just a sideways TV with a YouTube subscription?
It basically is, yeah. It's basically it's a high-tech fitness video.
It shows you what I know. Nonetheless, the strategic rationale, basically, as you indicated, we don't know too much about Mirror. However, we look at Mirror competitor Peloton. For their latest quarter, they said revenue surged 66% year over year. Then you look to Lululemon, the revenue fell 17%. Clearly, Lululemon looking to diversify the revenue base, capitalizing on the fitness at home trend. Last thing I wanted to touch on this week, legendary hedge fund manager Chan Paulson, he's returning external capital, converting his hedge fund into a family office, which we've seen being done by other legendary managers such as David Tepper, George Soros, Stan Druckenmiller, Louis Bacon, all these managers who really came to the forefront in the 90s and 2000s and made just a crap ton of money and effectively are retiring after making billions of dollars. Now his retirement here, just a continuation of that passing of the guard as managers who launched 20, 30 years ago. They're just, you know, they don't really have a reason to keep going. Perhaps returns have come down. You don't really want to deal with clients anymore because they have billions and billions of dollars. And this also allows young and up-and-coming firms to take their place. So if Paulson Investors, if you're looking for a manager, should check out what Accelerate's offering. We definitely can replace that merger arbitrage mandate that he was really known for. But what's super interesting about Paulson's story is he is most well-known for a so-called greatest trade ever, in which his firm purchased credit default insurance, CDSs, against billions of dollars of subprime mortgages prior to the market collapse in 2007, in which they banked profits for the fund of $15 billion, and he raked in nearly $4 billion personally. So quite the payday off that one investment thesis, super prescient investment thesis he had back 13 years ago. Some background on his firm. He actually had pretty much no experience on the credit side. He was a merger arbitrager. He launched his firm in 1994 with $2 million of his own and family and friends' capital, solely doing risk arbitrage. That fund grew to $300 million by 2003, so over 9 years, solid returns, good growth. But at its peak, Paulson was one of the largest funds in the world. In 2011, they had about $38 billion in capital. And ever since, their main strategies, Paulson Advantage, et cetera, they've made heavy bets on pharmaceuticals, a bet after the global financial crisis on U.S. banks. And they kind of mistimed those. So given underperformance after their huge win in 2007, 2008, a lot of that client money went out. So assets went from a peak of $38 billion down to less than $9 billion, most of which is Paulson's own fortune. So it really doesn't make sense if you don't have much client money anyway. The fund or the firm will continue to exist as a family office. And what we've seen is other hedge funds converting to the family office. They tend to complain that, you know, the institutionalized LP base kind of handcuffs them from a volatility perspective. We saw that with Blue Crest and Michael Platt, didn't we, Mike, where he converted his firm into a family office and then absolutely crushed it once he felt he could take more risks.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you do move to a family office structure, when, as you had mentioned, the quotes that I had seen this year for what percentage of the assets that his own wealth, John Paulson's own wealth made up was 75 to 80% of the firm's assets. So you have a lot of effort going into client relationships, and you're thinking about the firm as a business in terms of you're looking at strategies that can be marketable to outside investors, yet your own assets make up 75 or 80%. So you're putting in, you know, maybe 40 or 50% of your time, and I think that's being conservative, is spent on client development, yet, you know, you're the value you're getting from that is less and less by the day with each redemption. And so it really just comes back to now he's able to just focus on investing and making returns rather than having to worry at all about the marketability of funds and what's going to sell to LPs. He can just focus on making money. And I think that's very interesting. And Julian, there was something that we were talking about offline with regards to style drift. And I think you had some interesting comments there.
Yeah, that's a good point. I saw some people saying, oh, the reason that he's shutting down or the reason he did so poorly in the sort of back one third of his career leading to the conversion of his firm to a family office was said, oh, he had style drift. He was a merger arbitrager and tried all this other stuff that didn't work out. But in my opinion, there's no such thing as style drift. In this game, if you're not constantly improving and evolving with the market, then you're dead in the water. You're not going to be successful. So what they call style drift, I call progression and being opportunistic. And if you look at Paulson's career, he was, you know, a real example of that because his expertise starting out was in merger arbitrage, and that's what he was known for. And then he was opportunistic in representing a once-in-a-generation opportunity with subprime CDS on the housing market. So we recognize that opportunity in which he really had zero expertise in. A lot of industry experts were, you know, talking trash about him, saying he didn't know what he was doing and he's going to lose all his money. And he sure showed them. So one point is that it's progression, not style drift. And, you know, if you're not progressing, then you just can't be successful. You can't have a successful career investing. And the other thing is that really interesting dynamic in certain industries, many lose sight, like many experts lose sight of kind of the forest for the trees, such that they're so, you know, tied into the industry that they can't recognize, you know, big macro issues. And specifically here, Paulson recognized that the mortgage market was overheating and many specialists couldn't see it because they're too involved. And it's an interesting example of sector specialists. It's rare, if ever, that you see sector specialists be completely bearish and want to short everything in their coverage environment. In fact, I don't think I've ever seen that. So there's this inherent bias to be long of sector specialists. That's why I've always been a fan of being a generalist, because generalist has the best opportunities or the best kind of visibility to recognize opportunities, so you can judge the attractiveness and the risk reward dynamics of, you know, merger arbitrage compared to shorting energy bonds, to going long mortgage securities, to you know, whatever it is, distressed debt, derivatives.
And Julian, just to go back to the style drift comment as well, is to be very clear with his CDS bet, that was a special vehicle set up for that particular.
It was a new fund. Yeah, he had his Paulson so credit fund.
Yeah, and so he wasn't just putting it in a merger arb fund. That would be something that we would not agree with. If you're invested in a merger arb fund, you're invested in a merger arb.
Yeah, you got to stick with the mandate for sure.
Yes, exactly. You stick with your mandate. But so what he would have done is gone to his investors, said, hey, I have this opportunity that I think would be right for you. So he would cross sell to all those investors, but then they wouldn't be obliged to invest in that new strategy. If they thought if he was compelling in his description of the opportunity, then he would garner assets. And if not, there's no issue there. So that's one thing that I did want to point out in terms of style drift. And as well, when you talk about adapting as an asset manager, really that was just a function of him growing John, the Paulson & Co. from just, you know, a single couple of niche funds into a more wide-ranging actual asset manager. And that's what every large asset manager does. That's not unique to him. That's just part of, you want to offer your clients as many strategies as they are in demand from their end, and as long as you were able to do them well. And Paulson did show that he did have some skill in finding opportunities such as this. So I really just think that was part of him building Paulson & Co. as a business, which is what any smart asset manager or entrepreneur would do in that situation was a very astute move.
Yeah, the other thing to keep in mind was he had a similar call on gold, very bullish on gold, which I think was a good call, worked out well for him, but that never really got him the admiration nor the asset flows that the credit trade did. The other thing that investors should keep in mind is that a lot in this business is just driven by performance chasing. Obviously, all the money came to him after he made huge gains and assets exploded from, you know, single digit billion to nearly 40 billion. And when he had those flood of assets, then performance kind of started to decline. So I think on a dollar basis, I'm not sure if he made money long term for clients, but certainly his IRRs were very, very high. And just a warning to investors, don't kind of get in and out performance chase. And there is this sort of reversion to the mean that ends up disappointing investors because you see someone with a hot hand, very good returns, and studies show that those aren't not only not persistent, but tend to reverse. So that's something to keep in mind to not chase the hot hand, not performance chase, and really just try to stick with a well thought of asset allocation plan that covers all your bases in terms of asset classes, going beyond the traditional 60-40, such that you do cover these alternative strategies, but don't just look who has the greatest year-to-date performance. But that's about all I got to say. Hope you guys enjoyed episode 75 of the Absolute Return Podcast. If you enjoyed it, please check out more at absolutereturnpodcast.com. Would really appreciate it if you went on, gave us a review, give us a rating. Definitely helps the podcast grow, and we're seeing great growth, which we truly enjoy. We appreciate that. We put in a ton of work to this, so if you can tell your family, friends, colleagues, that would be awesome. We're trying to cover everything that investors like to hear: hedge fund strategies, merger arbitrage, SPACs, etc. We really enjoy it too. So with that being said, wish you all the best in your trading, shorting, speculating, arbitraging this week. Hope you had a great long weekend, and we'll chat with you next week. Cheers.
Thanks for tuning in to the Absolute Return Podcast. This episode was brought to you by Accelerate Financial Technologies. Accelerate, because performance matters. Find out more at accelerateshares.com. The views expressed in this podcast are the personal views of the participants and do not reflect the views of Accelerate. No aspect of this podcast constitutes investment, legal, or tax advice. Opinions expressed in this podcast should not be viewed as a recommendation or solicitation of an offer to buy or sell any securities or investment strategies. The information and opinions in this podcast are based on current market conditions and may fluctuate and change in the future. No representation or warranty, expressed or implied, is made on behalf of Accelerate as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Accelerate does not accept any liability for any direct, indirect, or consequential loss or damage suffered by any person as a result of relying on all or any part of this podcast, and any liability is expressly disclaimed.